This is Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Saver wins the Derby for Top Pletcher.
The Salt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all Have Another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And Dialed In never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Presented by Basic Tipton. Now, here's Mike Penna.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to the show Trainers Listen To. It is Trainer Talk presented by Basic Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, with you once again in our Lexington, Kentucky studios and ready to roll for the next hour, where each week I bring you the inside stories of those people that really do make this game a success. And yeah, you know I'm talking about the trainers of our sport, and can't wait to visit with the pair of trainers that I have on the program here tonight. Paul Holtis is going to join us in the first half of the program, and he will be followed by Ingrid Mason. So it's an all Oaklawn edition of Trainer Talk here tonight. And do want to welcome everybody joining us throughout North America on Sirius 220, XM Channel 206, and everybody joining us around the world on your smartphone, your tablet, and on your computers with our live streaming at horseracingradio.net. Paul Holtis is the son of the late trainer Bob Holtis, one of the most respected and revered trainers ever to come along in the sport of thoroughbred racing. He returned to training about 1 year ago after a 19-year hiatus. But even though he was away from the game, he was never really away from the game. And you're going to find out what that means here in just a second. Paul, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, happy to have you on board. And, you know, I mentioned stepping away from the training side of things, but even though you weren't training horses, you were still involved with racing on many different levels.
Yeah, that's correct. When I initially quit training horses, I took Garrett Gomez's book and went to Churchill. And I had Garrett do part of Churchill, and then he decided to quit riding on me and had a couple other jockeys for a while. And then I ran Tex Sutton, the horse plane that flies the horses around the country, for 8 years. And after that, I hustled book for a few years again and decided to get back into training.
Now, you're like a lot of trainers that have joined me on the program where you were, let's say, born into it, so to speak, because your dad was a trainer. If I'm not mistaken, his father was a trainer. So you were almost destined to be involved with thoroughbred racing on some level.
Yeah, that's for sure. That's basically all I've ever known, and all I've really ever done is been in the horse industry in some capacity.
So you grew up working with your dad. Take me back to the beginning and look back on some of those early days where he would take you to the racetrack and you'd be around the barn.
Yeah, I actually worked for him, obviously, every summer around the barn and anytime he was at Oaklawn. And the horses were leaving to go to Keeneland one spring, and I wanted to go and was 16 years old in 11th grade. And they said, well, you need to graduate high school before you can go with your dad. And went down and took the GED test and passed it and brought it home to him and said, I'm going with my dad. So basically I started working for him when I was 16 and running the shed from that point on.
So it was all you ever knew? This was all you ever wanted to do?
Yep.
Wow. And so what are some of your earliest and fondest memories of working with your dad?
Well, he always had a large stable of horses. So, you know, when you're around that many horses, obviously you get to see a lot of things, you know, quicker than you do when somebody's got 10 or 15. We carried around 60 horses all throughout my early career with him, you know, and so when you have that many horses, you see a lot of different things, and he was fortunate enough to have some good horses and also claimed a lot of horses early on, so, you know, you got to see a little bit about that part of the game, so you got a very good experience.
He had some really nice horses, too. Lawyer Ron comes to mind, Pure Clan. What was the first horse that really put your dad on the map?
Proper Reality.
Yeah, what made him so special?
Proper Reality won the Arkansas Derby, then later on won the Met Mile, and, you know, was the first really national Grade 1 horse that he trained.
What do you think was a bigger thrill, winning the Met Mile or winning the Arkansas Derby, being a native?
I think I think, you know, probably winning the Arkansas Derby might have been just a little bit bigger, but the Met Mile was a big deal to him. That was he beat an entry of Suge McGee's Dancing Spree, and I can't remember who the other horse was that day, but they finished within a head of one another. You know, and it was a huge, huge stretch battle, and it was a big race.
Wow.
That was one of Jerry Bailey's, first big horses on his career to get his career started. And in Jerry's book, he even, comments on Dad giving him a big shot on that horse and getting his career started off.
Wow. Were you with him that day?
No, I wasn't. I was with the rest of the horses that were at Louisiana Downs, actually. So, he traveled to New York to run that horse, but I was working for him at the time, but we were at Louisiana Downs with the rest of the horses.
Wow, that's a great story. I'm sure Jerry, very appreciative of your dad and everything that he did for him. Your dad also had a special relationship with John McKee, didn't he?
Yeah, John McKee basically got started, with him and, became his go-to rider when he was winning a lot of stakes and rode Lawyer Ron, and I think it was very... Dad was very significant in his early career.
So what finally led to the decision of your decision to step away from working with your dad and go out on your own?
I think it just comes to a point that you decide that, you want to start doing it for yourself. And the first year Remington started, I went to Remington with his horses and trained his horses at the very first meet over there in 88 and had a lot of success and did very well. And then the next meet, I decided to stay over there and went on my own and started then.
What kind of advice did your dad give to you when you went out on your own?
I don't know if he specifically gave me any advice when I went on my own. I think he pretty much had taught me a lot of things all along the way. And the main thing is to treat people right and treat people just like how you would want to be treated.
Yeah, I read somewhere, it might have been right after your dad passed away, you had a quote where you, and I'm going to paraphrase it, but you talked about him and his philosophy on training horses. He never took it too seriously. I mean, he was serious about it, but he never looked at it as kind of a life and death situation. Is that right?
Yeah.
Am I saying that right?
Yeah, I think so. And he always told me, the key to winning races, and if you want to be a good horse trainer, is have good horses and put them in the right place. They don't have to be fast. They just have to be faster than the ones you enter them with. And that's the key to winning races.
Talking with trainer Paul Holtis here on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. So, Paul, how would you sum up your philosophy and your approach to training horses now?
Basically the same way. It all comes down to having the best horse in the race. So whatever level that is, being able to evaluate your horse and putting him in a race that he has a chance to win is the key. There's all different levels out there, and if you continue to run them over their head, they're not going to be very successful. So, if you want to be successful, obviously you have to run them where they have an opportunity to win.
Yeah, what's that process like for a trainer in terms of selecting the right spot, and how much time do you put into studying condition books and those types of things?
Basically, I think that's a very, very important part of training horses is the condition book and picking the right races. You can take care of them all you want to and make the horse to be as good as he can be, but if he's not in the right race, he can't win. So that's a very integral part of training horses is picking the right races and being able to evaluate your horse and actually know what he's worth and his capabilities. I think that's something my dad was always very good at, and hopefully that I've carried on too, that basically where your horse can win is just put him in the right space, put him in the right race.
When you came back after the 19 years of not training and working as a jocks agent and working in the transportation field, did you feel like after your dad passed away, it was kind of your responsibility to carry on the family name and everything he had established?
Well, a little bit. It's great to carry on the family name, but basically I started looking at the way the purses are now and opportunities that are out there for horses to make money, and I started training with my own horses. I got back into the training game and owned them all myself because I thought that was the best deal for me, because you can run them exactly where you want to. You don't have to listen to owners manipulating where the trainer runs the horse or what they do. And some owners are great, and they let the trainer train the horse. But I do think that a lot of owners, you know, who are unbelievably successful in their own business, get into the horse business, and they don't let the trainer do his job. And so I think that's a key part to even an owner being successful. If you instill your horses into a trainer's responsibility, I think that, you know, he's the one that's making the living doing this, and I think that's a key part to being successful as an owner and a trainer.
Yeah, I've heard that from several trainers, Paul, that I've spoken with, and they've told me that one of the keys to being successful and having that good relationship with an owner is having an owner that understands the game and understands that the trainer knows the horse better than they do. And they really do, because you're with them all the time, 24/7, 7 days a week. You are with these horses. You're seeing them every day. You're putting their hands on them. And every trainer has told me that that's a big key. If you get an owner that understands that the trainer is the one who knows the horse and is calling the shots, so to speak, in conjunction with the owner, it really goes a long way.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, obviously when they have their money invested, you want them to be part of it. But they do need to listen to your opinions on, you know, when something's going south or something's not going right and you have a plan picked out for this horse, then that's generally a little better way to do it.
Tell me about the biggest challenges that you've faced over the past year since returning to training.
Actually, I've been pretty successful, and I don't know that there's been a lot of challenges. I just think that the key is trying to turn your... And pretty much when you're operating with claiming horses, you know you're going to lose some horses, so you have to keep that turnover going. Pick out good ones, and you know you're going to lose some, because if you're not losing them in claiming races, you're probably not going to win many races.
Yeah, I guess that's true. I guess that's a good way to look at it. Do you ever think about trying to get horses that would compete at higher levels, or are you happy with the claiming level?
Well, obviously, I'd love to have horses that could compete in the allowance level, but I think to get to have those kind of horses, you have to obviously invest more money, and we're working towards getting better and better horses all along, you know, and I think that's a key part of what we're doing. And I've taken on some owners as partners now, and that's helped a little bit with some expenses and stuff, and, you know, it's worked out really well.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about some of the owners that have supported you since you've been back. Talk about some of them.
Yeah, I have some childhood friends that I went to school with and have known since we were in grade school, Bob and Bridget Summers, both from Hot Springs, that we got, back reacquainted here a couple years ago. And then last year, I claimed the horse for them and myself, and the very first horse we claimed ended up winning three in a row, and we claimed her for $7,500, and she made $100,000 last year.
Wow.
So they got off on a good note, and now they own a piece of all of the nine horses that we currently have in training.
Wow. That's great to have that kind of relationship with your owners that are actually your friends. That has to make it a little bit easier too, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And he has no aspirations of knowing anything about, you know, the training part of it or anything. They're just enjoying the game, enjoying coming to the races, watching the horses run, and being part of it. And I think that makes it really, really good for me, you know.
I always wonder, when you are training or doing anything with people that are your friends in a business capacity, is it more difficult, Paul, when you have to go to them and you have to tell them, hey, your horse has to be laid off for a couple of months or whatever it might be? Is that more difficult when they're your close friends?
Not really. To me, I mean, the greatest thing about it is just be 100% honest all the time with them. Anything that happens, look, this is the way it is, and this is what we have to do. And when you have somebody that's just willing to accept anything that you tell them, it makes it really easy, you know. And, I mean, if you had to worry about every time you said something to them about what they were going to say or what they were going to do, it'd be really tough.
Now, if I'm not mistaken, your wife is also involved with thoroughbred racing, right?
Yes, she is. Her family's also been involved with racing all of her life. Her dad was a trainer and a jockey, and her grandfather was a trainer and a jockey. She then worked in the racing office at several different racetracks and was the stall woman at Hollywood Park for 10 years, while she also worked at TVG doing some announcing. And now currently she works at Oaklawn in the media department doing the paddock show, and also at Indiana Downs doing the paddock show.
See, now that has to be a gigantic asset to you, to have somebody by your side that understands what trainers go through, because I mention this on the program all the time. Paul, this is a 7-day-a-week, 365-day-a-year profession. There are no days off. You don't get holidays off like you would on a normal job, and we work weekends. But to have somebody that understands that has to be a huge benefit.
Absolutely. You know, to bring somebody from the outside world into the horse business and have them accept it is really, really difficult. Where she was raised in this business, she understands it, and they know. And, I mean, it is a very significant thing. And she also, we have a Magna Wave machine that she runs and works on our horses in the morning before she goes to the racetrack and works. So she's an integral part of the barn, too.
Paul Holt is joining me on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna in studio here in Lexington, Kentucky. Paul, of course, based at Oaklawn Park right now. Paul, where will you go after the Oaklawn meet?
I'm going back to Indiana. I'm going to Indiana Downs. We went up there last year and really liked it. Kevin Greeley and his staff up there do a wonderful job, and we're looking forward to getting back up there when Oaklawn's over.
How many horses do you have in training?
We have 9 here, and I'm going to pick up some horses for some new clients that are based in Indiana, and I'm going to have 16 up there this summer.
That's a good number. What's the goal?
I don't have a lot of aspirations of having a lot more than that. The health situation and everything being the way it is, I think the smaller I can stay, the better job I can do with the horses. I like being real hands-on, and I'm at the barn myself every day doing a lot of stuff. And personally, for me, I feel like I can do a better job with lesser numbers.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you get to see them every day. You get to, as you just said, put your hands on them every day. And I think that's significant.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Go back to the 19-year gap after you left training the first time before you came back a year ago. You mentioned working as a jocks agent with Garrett Gomez and some of the other riders, and then working with Tex Sutton Forwarding as well. Was it hard to stay away from training?
You know, I thought it would be easy when I left because of the Garrett thing. The money was really, really good, and that was what enticed me to change. You know, and also I had been going to Churchill, and my dad had made a decision to transfer his operation to Churchill. So I was going to lose a few horses that went that way with me because he was going a different direction. And so I was going to be down on horses. So I just basically thought it was the best financial situation for me. And, you know, I think I always miss the training part of it. I really do. I miss the horses, and I'd always help him around the barn. And, you know, it wasn't like I was completely away from it. And then, you know, doing the Tex Sutton thing, obviously I got to deal with all the major horses and trainers in the country there, because the horses that were flying were the premier horses in the nation. So, and I was getting to go to all the big races. And obviously that gets your interest back in wanting to be part of the sport at that level.
Yeah, that's tough, isn't it?
Yeah.
Have to go to all the big races.
You know, to be honest with you, when you go through the barn area and you see trainers that are successful and winning races that you feel like you are sure as good of, as good as or not better, you know, you look at it and go, man, I think I can make a living doing this.
Yeah, yeah. Do trainers actually set goals for themselves?
Man, my goal is to make money and pay my bills and make a living. So that's about my aspirations and goals.
Yeah, it's not an easy game to do that by any stretch of the imagination. When you were working with Garrett, and I really do miss Garrett on the racetrack because I thought he was as good as they get from a rider perspective. When he finally stepped away because of his personal issues, was that a little bit difficult for you to watch?
Absolutely. You know, here was a kid that you know, we went to Churchill and we were a third leading rider behind Sellers and Day, you know, having a phenomenal meet. And I think he had his, you know, whole career in front of him. And obviously some personal demons caused him to derail. And, you know, he came back and was very successful after that. And
yeah.
Unfortunately for him, but, I mean, I think without a doubt he had as much talent as any rider we've seen in a long time.
What made him so good and set him apart from some of the others?
You know, I don't think it's something that you can put a finger on of what makes a great jockey other than that horses just run for him. There's something about the Pat Days and the Jerry Baileys and those kind of guys that, for some reason, horses just run for them. They get horses to relax. they seem to make the right moves at the right time for whatever reason.
Who were some of the other riders that you spent time working with when you were an agent?
I had Aaron Grider for a while, Eddie Martin, Larry Melanson, Mickey Walls for a while, who
wow.
was a great kid that I really liked. Kurt Bork, you know, I had quite a few different jocks.
What's more difficult, training horses or being a jocks agent?
For me, I was never really happy being a jocks agent. For one reason, I could go out there and work as hard as I could work and get them on the horses, but I didn't have anything to do with that ultimate finish to the job. And so you go out there and you get them on these horses, and if they ride bad races, then you have to go back to these trainers and listen to them about something that you had no control over. And to me, that I don't like that. I like being in control of the you know, finished product, good or bad.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. Do you have a go-to rider or riders that you like to use in big spots?
For me, I mean, I've been real successful with John Court, and John Court's done well for me. I'm to be honest with you, I think it's horse racing. It's not trainer racing. It's not jockey racing. And whoever you have the relationship with, I don't think that jockeys make a big difference. I really don't, especially in day-to-day races. I think it's just whoever you have a good relationship with and you feel comfortable that tries on all your horses and that you can relate what you think needs to happen and they can carry that out. You know, I don't think it's so much that they have to be the greatest jockey. It's that relationship that you have with them that they can carry out what you want them to do.
Didn't you spend a little time working with Randy Morse before you came back too?
Yeah, me and Randy and myself have been really good friends for 20 years. And when I started to get back into the game, obviously I needed a job, and, you know, I helped him out, and he was very instrumental in the first couple of horses that we had together, and he let me keep them at his barn and was a big part of me getting started again.
Was his approach to training different than what you learned with your dad, or were they pretty similar?
No, they're different, and I think that's one thing that, you know, is really good, is to see different ways that different people do things and take from all of that. I left Dad in mid-'80s, went to California and ended up was assistant trainer for Wally DeLasse for a couple of years. And,
oh, wow.
You know, I think everywhere you go, you always pick up something, good, bad, or things to do differently.
Paul Holtis on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Paul, what about a horse that you've been around, that whether it was one of your dad's horses or one of your horses, that for whatever reason you're just never going to forget that horse?
I'd have to say it with proper reality also. He was the best horse that probably I was ever involved with in the training. I really wasn't around when Lawyer, I mean, I was there, but I wasn't part of the training process with Lawyer Ron at all or Pure Clan. So, you know, I think proper reality is always going to have that special place.
Yeah, I can imagine. You go on and win the Met Mile and then take the Arkansas Derby, or I guess vice versa, then it's you know, it's something that you're never going to forget, especially as a native of Arkansas. And I know you grew up in Hot Springs, so now you're training in your hometown. That has to be kind of cool. You get a lot of people coming out?
Yeah, absolutely. It's always good. Got a lot of friends that, you know, grew up here and that I've known from here for a long time, and it's always good to win at home.
Do they call you looking for tips?
Absolutely.
Do they get mad when you put them on a horse and the horse doesn't win?
Of course, they're gamblers.
That's what I think is the greatest thing about Hot Springs. I've only been there one time. We came down and broadcast the Rebel Stakes here on the network a couple of years ago, and it was an amazing experience because the whole town, a lot like Saratoga, the whole town is thinking horse racing when the meet is open. It's really cool.
Absolutely. The town opens up, and it's very well accepted, and it's a big deal here. You know, a lot of people go to the races, and still that real festive atmosphere, as in Keeneland, Saratoga, Del Mar. Those are about the only places left, Hot Springs, Keeneland, Saratoga, and Del Mar, that they have that festive atmosphere.
So, Paul, what does the future hold for Paul Holtis?
Continue training horses and trying to improve our stock and keep winning races.
Could you ever see yourself doing anything else?
Probably not. I think this is it.
Well, you made a pretty good choice, and not just because of your reputation and your name, but you're certainly making your mark on your own now as well, and want to wish you all the best moving forward. I always like to end, because we only have a couple of minutes left here, but I always like to end by asking trainers to tell us something that people might not know about them. So when you're not at the racetrack, what else does Paul Holtis enjoy doing?
Playing golf. In fact, I'm fixing to get out of this truck and swim club right now.
That's great. You're a pretty good golfer?
You don't have to be good. You just have to be better than the people you play with.
No, that's true. Do you play with a lot of the guys around the track?
Yeah, there's a lot, quite a few of us. Randy Morris and Cody Autry and Gene Short, the jocks agent, are playing today. So,
which trainer is the best golfer at Oaklawn?
I'm going to take the fifth on that one. I don't know.
It depends on the day, right?
Exactly.
Paul Holtis here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. Paul, again, can't thank you enough. We'll let you go ahead and loosen up and go play your round of golf, but really do appreciate it, and all the best moving forward. Like all of our guests who appear on the program, you're going to receive a gift courtesy of one of our sponsors, Flair Equine Nasal Strips. We'll get those out to you. And again, thanks so much and continued success.
All right, thanks a lot.
Paul Holtis here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. Doing the interview, that's kind of cool. David Fox did the interview on Trainer Talk. When he came on the show, he did the interview from his fishing boat. That might be the most wild place that anybody's ever done a Trainer Talk interview. Had several people do them in their car, but I think Paul might be the first one that I know of that was sitting in the parking lot of the golf course getting ready to go play golf. 405 wins, $4.6 million in purse earnings. Now, those numbers a little bit deceptive, because I mentioned the 19-year gap in Paul's training career. We talked about that. A jocks agent for Garrett Gomez, among others. Working at a transportation company. But this is always where his heart was. He always wanted to be a trainer. And you have to have that passion and desire to be successful. And Paul is doing that. And he's carrying on the family name very, very well. I can remember his dad passed away November 2011. One of the real good guys in the sport. So well respected. And Paul doing the very same thing. Somebody else who is earning an awful lot of respect is trainer Ingrid Mason. And she's going to be with me in the second half of Trainer Talk. Don't miss it. This is a great story as well. Stay with me. It's Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Celebrating 10 years of Eclipse award-winning coverage. Thank you for making HRRN your home for a decade of memories.
Looking for your next stable star? Then make plans now to attend the upcoming Fasic Tipton sales. The Fasic Tipton Texas 2-year-old in training and horses of racing age sale takes place on Tuesday, March 31st at Lone Star Park in Grand Prairie, Texas, and once again offers national sire appeal as well as significant Southwest bred value. Offerings include 2-year-olds by top sires Exchange Rate, Bladder, Northern the Fleet, and the last crop of Harlan's Holiday, as well as juveniles from the first crops of Uncle Mo, Haynesfield, Trap Shot, and Arch. On May 18th and 19th, the venue shifts to Timonium, Maryland with the Fasic Tipton Mid-Atlantic 2-year-old in training sale. And don't forget, nominations close April 1st for the Fasic Tipton July sale, taking place July 9th in Lexington, Kentucky. Download your catalog today and get more information on all the upcoming Fasic Tipton sales by visiting FasicTipton.com.
The New York Thoroughbred Breeding and Development Fund means business for New York. Together with all equine pursuits in the Empire State, we pay more than $187 million in taxes and provide 33,000 jobs. We provide scholarships for young people who want to join the New York horse industry, and we encourage everyone to support all thoroughbreds all their lives. Visit nybreds.com to learn more about why the fund means business.
Jude Feld, the pontiff of the Pick 4. You hear him on HRRN Radio. Now get his personal selections directly from him at his new site, PopeJude.com. Every analysis sheet at PopeJude.com has his personal selections and insights. Each page is a handicapping lesson packed with years of racing knowledge, coupled with insider information gleaned from the pontiff's countless connections in thoroughbred racing. Whether you're looking for another set of eyes on the past performances or inspired racing analysis to assault the windows, PopeJude.com is the site for you.
Since 2006, the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund has provided critical financial assistance to some 60 riders who have sustained catastrophic on-track injuries. The lives of these former athletes who have given so much to the sport of horse racing have been changed forever. I'm Mike Penna, president of the Horse Racing Radio Network and proud supporter of the PDJF, and I ask you to join me in supporting this outstanding organization right now by texting the word jockey to 50555. You'll be credited with a $10 donation that can literally change the lives of those disabled riders who need it so much. It's quick, it's easy, and it's only $10. Who would think a simple $5 Exacta box would mean so much to so many? So let's all help make a huge difference in the lives of those riders who have given us so many great memories. Text the word jockey to 50555 today and visit pdjf.org to learn more. Message and data rates may apply. Terms mgive.org/chi.
If you haven't already made the Horse Racing Radio Network your home for thoroughbred racing action, then now is the time to visit horseracingradio.net. Check out our broadcast schedule to see where and when we will be bringing you the best in thoroughbred racing from the rail to your radio. As always, you can listen to our free live streaming anywhere in the world at horseracingradio.net. Also, make sure to follow us on our Twitter page at twitter.com/HRRN or on our fan page on Facebook. We'll bring all the best racing information to you with broadcast information, pictures from the track, and news updates as soon as we hear it. Remember, that's twitter.com/HRRN for all the updates as soon as we hear them. Don't miss out on all the action. Get in the game with Horse Racing Radio Network today at horseracingradio.net. That's horseracingradio.net.
HRRN's newest show is Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. Every Tuesday, Mike Penna and Christina McManigal will bring you exclusive interviews with the best jockeys in the business. Tune in on our website for a new episode every Tuesday at 6 p.m. Eastern. Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, exclusively on horseracingradio.net.
This is Al Stahl, and you're listening to Horse Racing Radio Network.
Welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. This is, of course, the show trainers listen to, and every week I get the opportunity to visit with so many of the people that make our sport a success. They are the people that are at the barns 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock in the morning. They put in the morning training, they go back, maybe they take a nap, they get something to eat, and they're back in the afternoons for the racing. It's an amazing profession. It can be very rewarding, but you have to have a passion for it. You can hear that in all the guests that appear on this program. They all have that passion to be around the horses, to be around this game. And you can't succeed as a horse trainer unless you have that passion. Great visit with Paul Holtis in the first half of the program. Looking forward to visiting with Ingrid Mason here in the second half. And you talk about a young lady who has a passion for the sport. Ingrid certainly does. She's a native of San Jose, California. She has saddled 224 winners with more than $4.6 million in purse earnings to date. But probably no greater winner than Sarah Siss, the 3-year-old daughter of Sharp Humor, who won this past weekend's Grade 3 Honeybee at Oaklawn, providing Ingrid with her first career graded stakes win. Ingrid, congratulations and welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Happy to have you with me. And, you know, it's interesting when you look up your statistics on Equibase, it now lists you as a graded stakes winning trainer. How cool is that to see those words next to your name?
Yeah, it's pretty cool. I mean, You know, you always try to get it, or you always strive for getting horses like that, but, you know, there's people that do this for years and never have the opportunity to have a horse like that. And, you know, she's, you know, they're one in a million, you know, that you know, she's a blessing for sure.
Take me back to Saturday afternoon. The chart says that Sarah Siss pounced on her rivals. I thought that was a cool way to put it. What was it like watching her make that move?
It was awesome. I can't even describe it to you because it was such a thrilling moment, you know, first of all, to see her run the way she did. You know, we expected her to run well, of course. But, you know, when she made that move, of course, it was, you know, you get chills, you know, it's just, you get a chill. I'm like, holy crap. It was very exciting. To say the least, it was very exciting. And like I said, to see her just open up on him like that, and Julio just kept her at task and kind of wrapped up on her, but he kind of kept her, you know, so I saw there was another horse coming, and he really didn't ride her very hard at that point. It was pretty thrilling. Like I said, it was very exciting.
I have to tell you, I was a little reluctant to call you and ask you to come on the program because I didn't know how strong your voice would be, because I kind of anticipated that you'd be doing some screaming when Sarah Siss was making that move and coming down the stretch.
Yeah, no, I was doing some screaming, that's for sure. I gotta tell you, yeah, there was some screaming going on.
How about when she crossed the line? What was that feeling like?
One of the biggest thrills of my life, probably, you know, the one that I can say that relates to that, almost that same feeling, was when I won with Crooks Bodgett, when I only had a 3-horse stable, and he won a $100,000 race, and that was probably it was about equal to that moment, because that was a career changer for me, you know, and a life changer at that, because, you know, I was struggling at the time, and you know, like I said, it takes people to give you the opportunity to be able to get to where I am right now. And without those people's help, you know, your owners, family members, friends, everybody has to do, it's a team effort. And especially my help here, they do a great job. You know, it's a team effort to get a horse, any horse, to the winner's circle, or even to the races. It's a very challenging sport, you know, because one day you're on top of the world, the next day, you know, something happens to them, because they're very fragile. And you know, you can go through anybody's barn and they'll tell you the same. You know, it's like when you have a horse like this, you just pray every day that everything works right. The next day they don't get cast, they don't get cold, they don't get, you know, there's so many different things. They can get colic and numerous amounts of things. And so it's a, you know, everybody's got to be on the same page. And like I said, my help works really hard. You know, they monitor the horses. They try to, if they get cast, they get them up immediately, that sort of thing. And I'm in the process of actually putting a camera in her stall, because, you know, I want to be able to, you know, if something ever does happen, you know, we'd be able to see it right away, because it's a motion sensor type thing. But, you know, she's gotten cast before. I mean, they all do at some point or another. But anyway, you know, there's just so many different things that can go wrong more than they can go right. So when you do win a race, it's very, you know, you thank the good Lord and count your blessings, because it's not an easy sport at all.
Yeah, you're not kidding. You refer to the highs and the lows, and we say that, I say this on this program all the time, that it's, you know, a game that offers the highest highs and the lowest lows, and you can go from one to the other within a matter of seconds in this sport.
Exactly.
And one of the other highs in your career was when Sarah Siss provided you with your first ever win at Keeneland last October. And I know that was a really big moment for you.
Yeah, no, it was. You know, because I've tried to win there a lot, and I'd get close and just never got the candy. And then all of a sudden I had this great meet where I won 5 races. And, you know, it was very rewarding. Like I said, it's so difficult. I mean, you could be doing everything right, you know, working 24/7. And doing everything the best you can, it takes the animal and the team, you know, team and the animal to get there. You know, you don't have the horse that'll get there in the first place, and you're kind of, you know, out of luck. I mean, you have to have that, you know, the vehicle. So,
I loved your quote after that win at Keeneland, when you said, "My goal is to win races, and last year here was a struggle. That's why I went to the sales to upgrade my stock to compete here." Tell me about the process of finding better quality horses.
Well, you know, that's why I say it's such a team effort. You know, I have to have people that believe in me to put up the capital to go in and buy babies. And it's something that I believe I have a gift at. I've bought quite a few decent horses out of that sale and year after year. And so, like I said, it takes the first one to give you that opportunity. And George is one of the first owners I ever had. And he's probably, George Atola is probably one of the first people that went in with me and we bought babies. We bought Flower Spell, and she's made over 200 and change and done very well. But I paid $25,000 for her also in the beginning. So like I said, I had people now that are going in and they're wanting to put money into the sport, you know, and give me money to buy horses. And so that's what I'm very grateful for. I mean, Joe, you know, he went in, and Joe Ragsdale went in just recently, and he's been in with the 125 guys. So they kind of were in a partnership, and he kind of went off on his own and said, Ingrid, I'm going to buy a couple horses. This is how much money I want to spend. And so, you know, I must have looked at 500 head of horses and picked out ones that I thought would be in our price range. And that's basically how we got to our sis. You know, he's saying, do I bid on this one? I said, yeah, bid on her. You know? And he's like, are you sure? I said, yeah, because he wasn't going for that much money. And I think he was kind of concerned about that. And like I always tell him and tell everybody else, I'm one that double checks my work. So if I buy a horse, even though it has x-rays on file, I go and re-x-ray them. And as a matter of fact, that in that particular sale, we probably turned about three horses back. So, we turned three horses back that didn't pass. So, and they actually had x-rays that were good on file and said the horse was fine. And actually all three of them. And, so I always re-x-ray, you know, and just because, and not because anybody's cheating, it's because I've been doing this a long time, long enough to know that, like if I have a horse that gets a little off or whatever, and I x-ray him and nothing shows up, well, a week later I have something show up. So I'm really try to do my due diligence and do my homework. And I believe that's really important.
Visiting with trainer Ingrid Mason here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fazy Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. She is one of racing's newest graded stakes winning trainers, having won the Grade 3 Honeybee at Oaklawn this past weekend. Ingrid, take me back to the beginning. Where did the love affair with horses and racing begin for Ingrid Mason?
Well, you know, that's a long story, let me tell you. But when I was very young, I was 2 years old, and I had a love for horses then and had no fear. When my mom could tell you a story about that. So as a young person, I worked at a farm called Bucknord Ranch for free. And I must have worked 13, 14 hours. They should come home with bruises everywhere. That's all I want to do is be around horses. But I've always been extremely competitive. And even when I was young, I always wanted to go fast. It was always something fun for me. And I just always loved the horse. I mean, the horses are just such amazing animals. And the fact that they let you ride them, they're this big, giant, coolest, most majestic animal you could ever imagine. I let a person, you know, get on their back and ride them. And I just was fascinated by it. And like I said, I've been in love with horses since I was very young. But my first I was a model, and I made enough money to buy my first horse because my family didn't have a lot of money to buy horses. So I figured out a way to make it happen. So I bought my first horse, an Arabian, and I broke it myself, and nobody ever taught me anything. I broke this horse, and actually he ended up actually being a racehorse. Kind of a funny story, but I found a gal in Pleasanton, California that trains them, and I figured out a way to get into the track. And so I called her up and said, I have this horse. I want it to be a racehorse. I don't have any money, but I'll work, you know. So she put me to work and taught me a lot of stuff. I learned how to gallop from her. We used to go to the mountains, and she taught me. I always knew how to ride, but I didn't know how to gallop. It's a different type of riding, of course. So she took me to the mountains, and I learned how to gallop horses there. And then eventually I took out my gallop license and one step at a time. Like I said, I worked really hard. I mean, I didn't care how many hours I had to work or how hard I worked. I just wanted to learn the game. So I learned how to do legs and all that sort of thing. And, you know, I watched my first Kentucky Derby and I said, I want to ride races. So, I learned how to ride races. And so I did that for about 15 years, in between, training them as well, on the side with my ex-husband. We did that, kind of a long story, but, went through a lot of different trials and tribulations through that for sure. But I loved what I did. It was a dream come true. You know, you know, I had a dream and I made it happen.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
Yeah. It's a great story and so much perseverance involved with your story and with so many of the trainers that I visit with on this program, because you have to have thick skin in this game and you have to be able to stay the course, because you know that there's going to be times where things just don't go right. So let me ask you this, Ingrid. When you do reach the top of the mountain, so to speak, and you win a $100,000 race or a grade three, as you did this past weekend, is there a sense of vindication that, hey, you know what? I paid my dues. I'm at this point. I earned it. And everything I believed in actually does work. Is there part of that too?
I don't think so. You know, this game is so humbling, and I'm very humble when it comes to that. I'm just very grateful to have the horse to get there. You know, I believe that I've done a great job, you know, and I try to do that every time, every horse that I have in my barn. You know, I told you, I every horse in my barn, I train differently. Not one of them has the same, or I don't have a set course for every, you know, every horse does this this day and that the other day. Every horse in my barn trains differently. And I believe that needs to be just like, because horses are like people, they're animals, they're not machines. And so they all have different personalities. Some of them are high strung, some of them are kind of lazy, some of them, you know, they all have different personalities and different needs for training in different ways because of their personalities. So that's what I do. I try to go by what the horse tells me and what they need. And it's always adjusted too. You know, sometimes you try one thing and it doesn't work. You got to be resilient and say, hey, let's try something else, because you're always learning in this business. It's not, you know, like there's a set way to do something and that's it. You always have to be flexible. And, you know, and like I said, there's so many different, just like the thing with people is people can talk to you. You know, you have to be able to listen to the horse. And the horse doesn't speak English, but they certainly have gestures that'll teach you and tell you what they need or don't need. And so, like I said, I'm always learning. I don't know everything by any means, but I try to constantly keep my mind open to learn new things, to get better at what I do. And that's my goal. I mean, obviously, everybody's goal is to kind of want to win those types of races and have that and be with, you know, those kind of people and do all that. But it's, like I said, it's you have to have the horse to get you there. That's number one, you know, and I'm very grateful for the opportunity that's been given to me. I've had a lot of great owners that have supported me through the years that without them, I'd be nowhere, without a doubt. So, you know, it takes somebody to get you started. And of course I had to have the means and the how-to to keep going with it and be successful. But like I said, without the opportunity, you're nowhere. So
yeah.
I'm extremely grateful to everybody that has supported me through the years, because it certainly makes a big, big difference to my career.
Yeah. And you made a statement when we first started visiting here tonight that you don't get anywhere without help from other people in this sport. And that's so true. You need people to help you along the way. So who were some of the people, Ingrid, that helped you most when you were first getting started?
Well, you know, it's all the way from the beginning when I went through a rough period, and when I started, I had Jim DeVito. I became his assistant when I had horses in training in Florida, and I pretty much got, it's a long story, but the hurricanes took out my horses and this and that, and I was in Florida. I had no money to go to California anyways. I was supposed to go to a hearing. Something that happened when I was a jockey, and I couldn't make the hearing because I had no money to get on a plane to go. And I asked for a continuance. They wouldn't grant it to me. So anyways, I got my license suspended. So, basically I lost all my horses, from the hurricane, number one. So then I started galloping. And then when I started galloping, that's when this thing, came to a head where they suspended my license and I got removed from the track at one point. So I had to figure out a way to make a living. So I've gone from one extreme to the other, you know, tremendous extreme, and I struggled. And, you know, and Jimmy DeVito got me, I was at the races at Gulfstream, and I met up with a friend, and I met up with somebody, and I told him that I need a job on the track. I was trying to get my license back and this and that. And so Jimmy offered me an assistant trainer's job. And oh my God, when I got my license back, cost me $4,000 later. It took me 2 years actually to get that accomplished. And I worked for him, and it was like I felt like I'm working really hard as an assistant. I didn't care. I was just so happy to be there, just so happy to be on horses again and have my life back. I can't even explain that to you how rewarding that was. And I thank him so much for giving me that opportunity to get back on the track, because I couldn't figure out a way to make it happen. And I worked for him for almost a year. And then after that, I kind of got a few horses on my own, about three head of horses. And then and during that time, I was galloping horses for Steve Asmussen and all of that. So I was galloping I was his work rider, and then at the same time I was also taking care of three head of horses for, you know, Georgia Tola gave me an opportunity and gave me a couple horses and another owner.
You know, Steve Asmussen is probably one of the better people to learn from. And I know that he's been in the headlines the past couple of years for things that probably weren't true. But here's a guy that knows how to win races. When you were galloping for him, were there things that you picked up on, maybe things that he did that you still are able to use to be successful today?
Oh, for sure. For sure. I mean, every trainer that I've worked for in the past, from Brian Corner to Jerry Hollendorfer to Jimmy DeVito to Steve Asmussen, I've learned from all those guys. And that's what, you know, my drive to do what I do, I absorb everything. I mean, the best part about how fortunate I've been to work for different people and not the same person is I see how all these different trainers do things. And so I'm able to pick and choose what I feel is really smart and really cool, what I thought was, you know, really worked. And then I've kind of made my own training regiment based upon that. And like I said, I'm very particular about the fact that I train every horse a little differently. They're individuals and they're not all meant to be trained the same. Whereas there's a lot of trainers I've worked for that have their regiment. They do it regardless. You know, some guys, they work them, you know, work the horses after 10 days after a race, and that's what they do. And then they work them another 7 days, and you know, they go in a certain time they want to go, and that's what he does, and that's it. So, and I've seen other trainers do things, you know, a lot differently. So I'm one of those where, like I said, it's every horse is an individual. You pull blood on them, you know, you're good horses, you find out where they're at, and then you train them accordingly. But like I said, they're all different. And that's kind of, you know, how I've based my training that way. Because, you know, I've watched all these different people do things and some great things, and I've been very fortunate to learn from them, for sure.
Do you get on your horses in the morning, Ingrid?
I do, but not here. And the reason why is because Oak Lawn is, you know, it's a very, there's a lot of traffic. It's like a cavalry charge out here. So what I do is I go with the pony, my lead pony, and escort my horses back and forth to the racetrack and on the track because it's needed here. When I go back to Arlington on a more quiet track, I start getting on them because they don't need me with a lead pony.
Yeah, so, are there some advantages to being on your horse in the morning?
There is. There's a lot of advantage, and there's a lot of advantage being on the pony and going beside it because you can see and feel, you know, how the horse is going. And you can always tell, you know, I mean, I rode for years and I learned a lot by riding horses on how they feel and when they're ready, you know, when they're ready to explode or when they're ready to run. And there's a difference. There's a big difference. You learn about how a horse's mind is. Like some people say, oh, that horse is nervous or that horse is feeling good. I know the difference between a feeling good horse and a nervous horse. And, you know, when a horse is jumpy, they say, oh, that horse is it, put him in, he's ready to run. And that's not always the case. You know, some horses get overly stimulated and they're just, you know, they're probably stressed out maybe from the race or from whatever, why horses act a certain way. So my job or any trainer's job really is to try to be a mind reader or I don't know what you'd call it, but somebody has to really know what's going through that horse's head and read the horse's body language mostly. And it's, there's a slight bit of difference between the two of when a horse is nervous or when they're ready to run, when they're excited. And there's a little difference. And you know, we need to learn how to, and also when there's something wrong with the horse, sometimes horses will act out of sorts when something's wrong. You know, maybe they've got something wrong that's not showing up yet. And, you know, horses start acting out of sorts when there is something like that. And you'd be really surprised because I've seen it more often than not. You know, horses have tragic injuries and they'll start acting up when they don't normally. And so I always try to listen to them and figure out what's going on inside of them.
Ingrid Mason on Trainer Talk presented by Phasic Tipton. Ingrid, only about 3 or 4 minutes left here before we have to wrap this up, but want to ask you about your bucket list. What things are still on the Ingrid Mason bucket list moving forward?
Well, everybody's got the bucket list. You know, I mean, I always said I'm not going to the Derby until I had a horse running in it. You know, you always say that. I've never been to the Kentucky Derby on Derby Day because you try to watch it. You really can't because, I mean, you're mostly looking at people and you'd rather have a better shot watching it on TV, you know, because it gets so crowded. Just as I said earlier in another interview that I did, I said, you can't even find a place to stay. So I'm looking at the Oaks possibly for this filly, and I'm trying to find a place, a hotel to stay in. And, oh, my God, you're going to be sleeping on the floor because it's not easy to accomplish. So, but, yeah, I mean, the Kentucky Derby is definitely – on my bucket list. The Oaks is on my bucket list. Any big time race is on my bucket list. I look at Todd Pletcher and my mouth drops. I mean, he's a phenomenon. I don't, you know, he's somebody that I would have really liked to work for because I want to know how he runs his business because he's got so many strings of horses and he's so good at what he does. I mean, you know, time after time, and certainly he's got the horses in his stalls to make the difference, but he does an excellent job and certainly like to learn something from that guy because he's on my – I want to be like him.
Be like Todd.
That's on my bucket list. Yeah, well, he's amazing.
If Ingrid Mason wasn't training racehorses, what else would you be doing, Ingrid?
You know, I really don't know because horses, since as long as I can remember – have been, you know, something that I've been fascinated with. And so I guess the only thing I could say, we have to be something with horses. And I can tell you that because it's never come out of my mind, you know, to be with horses and do that. I can't work in the office. I've tried. Of course, anybody can do anything for a short period of time because they have to, just as I did. I worked in electronics. Making $10 an hour trying to sell for sound advice. You know, I did that to try to get by. So, I mean, you can do anything for a short period of time, but there's nothing, you know, I always believe in living your dreams, you know, do what's in your heart, you know, and I think you'll be successful at it. I tell people that all the time. And like I said, I mean, I was driven to this job. I mean, it was a hard struggle. It's not something that came easy. I worked extremely hard. None of my family is into horse racing or has any connections whatsoever. I got myself here. And a very, you know, long and hard road, which, you know, I learned a lot from it. And, you know, it's my drive that got me here. You know, being a jockey, doing everything I've done, I persevered because I believed in myself that I belong there and that I could do good at it.
And you have, and you've overcome so many things to get to where you are, and you're finally being rewarded with a filly like Sarah Siss. And Ingrid, want to wish you all the best with Sarah Siss moving forward. Hopefully we get a chance to visit at the Kentucky Oaks. Let's hope everything stays on track, and want to wish you all the best there, and thank you for coming on the program. Like all of our guests, you're going to receive a gift courtesy of one of our sponsors, Flair Equine Nasal Strips. I will send those to you. And again, can't thank you enough, and all the best moving forward.
Thank you very much. I use a lot of those things. It'll work out great.
There you go. We'll get you some more samples.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Ingrid. Ingrid Mason on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. Paul Holtis in the first half of the show. If you missed any portion, go to our website, horseracingradio.net. This show, all of our Trainer Talk shows, all of our programming is available via podcast on our site, horseracingradio.net. Fun stories, perseverance. I keep telling you every week, that's what it's all about in this game. For our producer, Lee Delapina, I'm Mike Penna. We'll talk to you next time on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton.